Exactly. Yeah, a wet one. Questions? It's an iPod. It's an iPod Nano. Because it's nano, right? So, just imagine how big the real iPod is. If this is, it's going to be a billion times bigger than this. It's about the size of a county.
That'd take a lot of money.
Okay. Questions? So we've been solving Laplace's equation for a while in two dimensions. Laplace's in one dimension was so easy we didn't even bother to talk about it. And we got these solutions. I think it's no surprise about all of this. So I invite you to rewrite this solution in a dimensionally correct way. You don't have to do it this way, but it's often helpful to do it that way. And I remind you that if I were writing a book, I can't really write it like this because the terms aren't independent, right? I could multiply both A and C by 5 and divide these guys by 5 and I'd have exactly the same solution. So really what I'm saying here is we get an arbitrary linear combination of these four solutions. But typically what's going to happen is you're going to have some symmetry, say an angular symmetry, and there won't be any sine terms. And you can kind of proceed as I think you would normally. Okay, so there's a little bit of notational problem here. Add up an arbitrary linear combination of this and this and that and that, and that's going to be a solution to Laplace's equation. That's the right exponent. So for spherical coordinates, it's this, but this is cylindrical coordinates, and then it's plus and minus exactly balanced. Okay, so here's the piece that doesn't depend on angle, and it doesn't fit into the formula, as well as the piece that doesn't depend on angle fits in here, right? The piece that doesn't depend on angle is just P0 being just 1. And in rectangular coordinates, we had this, and there's an overall system for how this thing works, and that is we have orthogonality, and so if we multiply both sides by our unit vectors and do a dot product, which looks like integration, we can isolate the corresponding term. And we have orthogonality for all of these guys, so we can always use that sort of point of view. The book's point of view is a little bit different. It says, if you just kind of fiddle with things, you can always see that it works out, often see that it works out. And that's okay too, but it's nice to know that there is a systematic approach which always works. Often you can use symmetry, right? Evenness or oddness to save half of your work. Inside, outside. So very commonly we have voltages inside a sphere, and then we can't have that because the voltage would be infinity at r equals 0. Or we have a voltage outside the sphere, and we couldn't have that because the voltage would be going to infinity, which at least is unusual. We do have kind of a special case that crops up, like in the homework problems, where we have a constant electric field. Then we do need to have the voltage go to infinity exactly like that to make the constant electric field. Right? If we have a constant electric field, the voltage has to be getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller forever as we follow the electric field vectors down. We had a special solution in the case where we could find the voltage along the z-axis, and then we could kind of for free figure out what the expansion coefficients were. Okay, questions on Laplace by orthogonal functions.
And you're saying our special case is what we did in our homework.
Yes, so you did a problem like this. It was example 3 in the handout. It was also problem 3 in the handout, I think. I can't remember. Okay, so then we started to talk about images, and images are kind of guess solutions where we can make something that satisfies the boundary conditions, and then by the uniqueness theorem, that has to be the solution. So the poster child for the image problem is the problem of a finding the voltage outside of a conductor where we have a point charge that is sitting at some distance, lowercase d, from the conductor. So the boundary conditions we have to satisfy is the voltage has to be zero on the conductor and there has to be a charge there. And we can do that by just inventing a non-existent charge, an image charge, that has a balanced location compared to the real charge. Because if I do that, then for an arbitrary point on the boundary, it'll be the same distance from minus Q as it is from plus Q. And so when it comes time to calculate the voltage, I'll get zero. The actual voltage inside of the copper is, of course, zero. So we don't literally take this thing as being the case. We can only apply this outside the copper, in which case this is going to be the formula for the voltage. And that allows us to do lots of things pretty easily, like we could calculate the force on this guy. It's just the force due to this fictitious charge, which is a distance 2d away, and it has charge minus q, so there's an attractive force, for example, that's given by that equation. Okay? So, more of these kind of special cases. We dealt with the case of a copper sphere where we have a charge Q that is sitting outside of it. And what we found is that if we located a fictitious charge Q prime that was at that distance from the center and had this magnitude, then it worked out that the voltage was zero on the outside, on the perimeter. If we had a voltage that wasn't zero on the perimeter, we could still make a constant voltage on the perimeter, which would be required, by adding a constant charge, some other charge, at the origin. In particular, if we choose this charge to just be minus Q prime, then we have the solution for an uncharged capacitor. Okay, so these are all kind of special cases, but they solve pretty easily, without doing any integrations at all, a variety of kind of interesting problems. Questions? Okay, so we've done planes, we've done spheres. Obviously, what comes next is cylinders, that sort of thing. So what if we have a infinite piece of copper, and we have a line charge that's going out of the board? Well, it's pretty clear that that we could solve the problem of having the voltage be zero on the boundary by having an image charge that is minus lambda. And I don't know, maybe this is vaguely interesting, but it's not actually a very commonly occurring physical problem. What is a pretty common physical problem is, instead of having a line charge, what I have is a piece of wire that is sitting some distance from the grounded plane. So this happens all the time, where you have a so-called ground plane, where you have a sheet of copper that is set to ground, and you run a wire at a fixed distance above it. And we're interested in the electrical characteristics of that, and in particular, the capacitance. We haven't talked much about capacitance because I know you remember it all from 200. So roughly speaking, capacitance is the proportionality constant between voltage and the correspondingly stored charge. And we'd like to know what the corresponding capacitance is of a wire that is sitting some distance from the grounded plane. What used to be a fairly common situation is what was called twin lead. And it consisted of two parallel wires that were separated by each other by some plastic. And this used to be used to carry TV signals around pretty commonly. The plastic was typically brown, and so we had this kind of flat stuff that had wires at either end. So wouldn't be bad to be able to figure out the capacitance of twin lead also. So. Well, pretty much these days people use coaxial cable to bring their TV signals around. I'm not sure I've seen any twin lead around for decades.
It's really thin, right?
It's not super thin.
Is it flat?
It's flat. I could bring in some, I think. So it's maybe a millimeter thick, and maybe the separation is about like that. and it's almost always brown. Maybe I'll bring in a piece of twin lead. It's pretty obsolete at this point. Well, what I need in order to solve this realistic problem is I need to have a isopotential surface equipotential that is a circle. And that, I don't know, that sounds moderately tough. If you take a look at this diagram, what we have, if you look at the code, is just the combination of two logarithms. And you remember, of course, that the voltage from a line charge is proportional to the logarithm of R. So I would have here a voltage that is logarithm of R from this guy and is minus logarithm of R from that guy. And that's exactly what the code is plotting. And you can see, of course, that I've got the contour that is zero voltage right between my two wires. The wires, again, coming out of the page. But if you look at those isopotential surfaces, boy, they look a lot like circles. Could it be that easy? Could it be that this solution nicely has isopotential surfaces that are circles so that I can use this simple solution as the solution to my more complicated problem? Well, of course, the answer better be yes, or I'd be wasting your time. But the process of doing it mathematically is, I don't know, moderately tricky, and I'm going to do it a little bit differently from the way the book does it. So setting up the kind of basic notation, I'm going to, so if you look at these pictures, notice that the center of these circles is not at any fixed location. And in particular, it's not where the wire is. So let's start by putting my origin at the center of one of those circles. And that's tough because I don't know the radius of that circle, but this is mathematics. We're going to start from there and then figure out where it is at the end. So I'm going to call the distance d prime, the distance that the image line charge is from my center. And I'm going to call the distance d that the real line charge is.
Wait, so can you say what the
x
is, where the point is?
There aren't any x's. Oh, yes, there is that x. Yeah, that's an x marks the spot. So I don't really know where the center of these circles are, but I'm kind of pretending I do currently. And in the end, I'm going to solve for where those centers of these circles are. So the d prime is the distance that this image charge is from that center of that circle.
Oh.
Yeah, so I'm thinking that the isopotential surface is going to kind of look like this. You can see that it surrounds where the wire is. And d prime is the distance from the center of the circle to the line charge. And d is the distance from the center of the circle to the real line charge. And while we're at it, notice that the distance to the center of the other circle, a distance I'll call L, that's just d plus d prime, right? Because it has to be symmetric. However far this image charge is from that circle, that's the same distance that the other one is from the other circle. Okay, L is something that we might actually measure, right? If I have a piece of wire, I can pretty easily measure the distance it is from the ground plane, and that's going to be half of L. This fictitious distance d and d prime, we can't measure those with calipers because we don't know where any of these things are.
And d is not the center.
So d is the distance from the center to the line charge. And the line charge is not at the center of that circle. It's an extra distance d prime further. Okay, so that's kind of the setup for the algebra. What we need then is formulas. So if I'm at some arbitrary location, I want a formula for the voltage at this location. And if we, so let's back up maybe one more step to remind you of stuff that should kind of have tattooed on your brain. What is the electric field from a line charge? So you remember you use Gauss's law. So you make a Gaussian cylinder like this. So you have 2 pi r l times the electric field. That's the flux. That has to be equal to the enclosed charge, which is lambda times l divided by epsilon naught. So the electric field from a line charge is going to be 1 over 2 pi epsilon naught r. And therefore, the voltage that's going to make that is going to be 1 over 2 pi epsilon naught natural logarithm of r with a minus sign or not. Okay, if I take minus the derivative of that, I get that. Okay, so the upshot is I'm going to be interested in these voltages, and I'm going to be continually writing 2 pi phi is equal to the natural logarithm of the distance from this wire. Right, let me call that r plus. And then, because this is a negatively charged wire, I'm going to have minus the natural log of the distance from the other wire. Okay, and that's what the voltage is going to be at an arbitrary location, to show that if I go around in a circle, the voltage doesn't change. Okay, so far so good. Oh, there would be a lambda here also, but I might as well divide out that lambda. So what are these distances? So if I'm at a location, so here is d prime. D prime is where I need to go to my image charge, which is going to be negative. And I want to figure out the voltage at some angle theta from it, which depends on this distance, right? And that distance from the law of cosines, or just working it out, is going to be the square root of d squared d squared plus r squared minus 2dr cosine of that angle. And I should write that as d prime because I wanted that one there. So lambda prime is it's actually minus lambda in the end. It's this image over here. So typically I use primes for the images and no primes for the other ones. In this particular case, the magnitude of these line charges is equal and opposite. Okay, so that's what r minus was. R plus, there's a very similar formula, right? Because it's the same sort of triangle. And this distance is just going to be the same formula with a d as opposed to a d prime. So you remember that the difference in logarithms is just the ratio. So what I'm going to get then is the natural logarithm of the square root of d squared plus r squared, and that should have been a d prime there, minus 2 dr cosine theta. That's r plus. And then the square root of d prime squared plus r squared minus 2 d prime r cosine theta. And what I'm looking for is for that to be a constant. I want a isopotential surface. So as I change theta, can this thing be a constant? Doesn't look constant, right? But we saw in the spherical case, we were able to make it be a constant if we chose all of the parameters to be, you know, the right ones. And the trick with the sphere was to kind of pull out the big thing. So for the top, the big thing is the distance to the wire. And for the bottom, the big thing is this distance r. So let's pull those things out and see what we get. So we've got the natural logarithm. I pull out the d. I'm going to have the square root of 1 plus r over d squared minus 2 r over d cosine theta. And in the denominator, I'm going to have r, the square root, and kind of rearranging terms, 1 plus d prime over r squared minus 2 d prime over r cosine theta. All of that is square rooted. Okay, and I hope you can see that this would work if r over d equaled d prime over r. Right? Those square roots would have exactly the same features. And in that case, then with this situation, then what we would have then would just be the natural logarithm of d over r. Okay, so you tell me what d and d prime are, and I can tell you the radius of the circle that would be a equipotential that we would need. But, I don't know, we don't know d or d prime, right? What we could physically measure would be L, the distance between the center of the wire and the ground plane, or in the case of twin lead, the distance between the centers. So, I don't know, it's good stuff, but it's not at least useful yet. How can we get out the quantity that we actually want? Well, so what we know is that the full length is equal to the distance it needs to go to the actual charge, and then we need to go that extra d prime to go to the extra center. And we know that d prime is the radius of the isopotential divided by d. That's just the rearrangement of the previous equation. And again, if this was a wire, L and R are things I could measure. D and D prime were distances from the center, and I didn't know where the center was, so those were all tough things to think about. So what I'm going to do is to take this equation and divide it all through by 2R. So if I do that, I get L divided by 2R. That's equal to D over R plus R over D. Okay, and so here's the trick that you're going to love. This is equal to the cosh of the logarithm of D over R. Obviously. Okay, so maybe not so obviously. So you remember that the cosh is e to the x plus e to the minus x divided by 2. So if I put in the natural logarithm for x, then I have e to the log, and those are inverse function of it, so I'm going to get d over r. And this is just going to give me the inverse of that, which is r over d, and I've got the 2. Yes, yeah, we've said that before. And therefore you remembered it. So cinch is the same thing, incidentally, with a minus sign. Okay, so if you love that, you're going to love the next step even more. But I remind you that there is a button like this on your calculator. Let's take the inverse cosh. Right? You have on your calculators, I bet, a button that is labeled inverse cosh. So you've never used it. Now we could actually use it. So the inverse cosh of L over 2R, those are all numbers that we could measure. That has to be the natural logarithm of D over R. And the natural logarithm of D over R was the voltage. Right? Aside from these factors that you remember that I kind of plonked on the other side of the 2 pi epsilon naught divided by lambda. So maybe I can put those two in there. So this was times 2 pi epsilon naught divided by lambda. Okay, so incidentally, the book does all of this in a similar but different way. I obviously like my way better. You can try their way. It doesn't involve things like inverse coshes, but you actually have that button on your calculator, and it wants to be used. So kind of the overall plan of this was to try and figure out what the capacitance was for these sorts of physical problems. So if we have something like twin lead, we've said that the positive voltage is lambda natural logarithm of D over R divided by 2 pi epsilon naught. Yeah, but twin lead is exactly the same thing as the wire going over the grounded plane. Because that makes the anti-wire for you, as opposed to having it be physically present. So for the commonly existing physical situation of a wire that is sitting some distance L over 2 on top of a grounded plane, this is going to be what the voltage is. So the capacitance is going to be the voltage difference, the charge divided by the voltage difference. And the charge is, of course, going to be lambda times L. And we've got the voltage being twice, right? This is going to be plus V, this is going to be minus V. So the overall voltage is going to be twice that. And that voltage was so we've said that voltage was inverse cosh of L over 2R. So I can see that the
what's that?
P. Yeah.
No, at the very beginning. Oh. No, at the very beginning.
This one?
Down left.
This one? Oh, that's the capacitance.
Okay.
Right? Voltage times capacitance is charge. Okay, so the upshot then is that the capacitance per length of twin lead is going to be equal to pi times epsilon naught divided by the inverse cosh of the full separation of the twin lead divided by...
Wait, what is the full
separation?
It's L over 2R.
Right there. Okay, so I don't know, maybe this wasn't worth the time, but the main point is to realize that the simple combination of logarithms produces isopotential surfaces that are circles, and circles, like wires, are things that exist all the time. So we can solve the problem of a charged wire sitting on top of a grounded plane by exactly this sort of approach. So that's actually a homework problem which I didn't assign, because it's not exactly pleasant, I guess, with inverse coshes in it. Okay, so now we've done image charges for cylinders and for spheres and for planes. So we're kind of done with image charges. Any questions? So what's next is to do computer solutions. So you may have been thinking that you've been doing computer solutions by using Mathematica, but what we're talking about here are cases where more general cases where the geometry is in general pretty ugly. I mean, so we have the elephant, the charged elephant, and we're trying to figure out what the voltage is a centimeter away from that elephant, right? If we're a meter from that elephant, we can probably use the multipole expansion, but if we really want to calculate things, we're going to need some sort of computed solution. Well, I'm not sure what my elephants look like these days. Ooh, looks more like a bird. Ooh, I don't know what it is. Big floppy ear, I don't know. Maybe we'd look better with a trunk, get some tusks, cut off that tusk and sell it for ivory. I don't know. So elephants are what we have in mind, but of course we're going to convert them into squares and things like that, just in order to make the problems simple enough. If we look at the basic formula for the Laplace equation, right, so that's the Laplacian of phi is equal to zero. And again, for simplicity, let's think about this in just two dimensions, say x and y. And for an arbitrary sort of situation, what I can do is I can make a grid of points, a lattice of points. And of course, if we were actually dealing with the elephant, we'd be having points that are in three-dimensional space. And of course, the Laplacian is two derivatives with respect to x on phi plus two derivatives with respect to y on phi. Who remembers from 200 the formula for calculating the second derivative of something when we have a lattice of points like this? Well, yeah, I'm not unhappy with a matrix, but so let's go back to 370, where we were trying to find the place where the second derivative of this is in the context of Langmuir's probe, where we were trying to find the spot where the inflection point was, where the second derivative was zero. And we wrote down a formula for what the second derivative was, where we had a series of individual points. Okay. Let's go through and think about that, first of all, in one dimension. All right, so there what we had was a series of voltages, and we had currents at those voltages, right, from the probe. And we wanted to calculate the second derivative. And of course, the first thing to do is going to be to calculate the first derivative. And I would say that an approximate value for the first, and let me give these points kind of names. Let me call this point 1, 2, 3, and 4. Approximately speaking, the derivative of the function at that point, I should be able to calculate as the value at the far point minus the value at the near point divided by the step size, which I'm going to call h. Right? So it's approximating a limit as just a quotient. And similarly, the value of the derivative at this point here, I should be able to do by taking the far point minus the near point and dividing it by the step size. And of course, the second derivative is the difference between the slope at these two points divided by the step size. So if I take this one here, F3 minus F2 divided by H, and I subtract this one here, F2 minus F1 divided by H, and divide it all by H, what we've got is everything's going to be over H squared, kind of makes sense. We've got one F3, we've got plus F1, and we've got minus two F2s. You kind of remember that? Not so much. So the second derivative at this point 2, I can calculate by adding up the points on either side and then subtracting twice the value of it. Does that all sound okay? So that's the so we found the derivative here and we found the derivative there. The midpoint of those two is nicely point 2, so that should be the second derivative at that point there. Okay, so if we apply the same idea to get the Laplacian, and so let's say we want to get the Laplacian at this point here, in order to get, so let me give these neighboring points names just so we're clear about them. Let me call this point here A, and this point here B, and this point here C, and this point here D. So to get the second derivative at the circled point, to get the derivative with respect to x, what I want to have is the voltage at B plus the voltage at A, the one circled point I didn't label. Let me just call that, okay, good. Then I want to subtract off the voltage at O. I want to divide that all by the step size h squared. Yes, thank you. To get the derivative with respect to y, I'm going to have the voltage at D plus the voltage at C minus twice the voltage at O divided by h squared. And if I rearrange things, what I'm going to have is the sum of the neighboring points, right? Phi A plus phi B plus phi C plus phi D minus 4 times the voltage at the original point. And the Laplacian is supposed to equal 0. And if that equals 0, can you see that phi is equal to the average, right, 1/4 of the neighboring points? Maybe. So first of all, I would comment that this is a fairly robust result. So I could prove, for example, that if we solve Laplace's equation and you picked a point in space and you average the values of the voltages on the surrounding sphere, you would get exactly the voltage at the center. You could make a general theorem like that. So incidentally, what that means is that there are always bigger or smaller values on a sphere that surrounds the point. Right? Otherwise, the average value at the center would be more than the more or less than what the average is. Okay, so that means that there are never maximums or minimums of the voltage in free space. The voltage is kind of the average value of the neighboring points. Smooths things out, as it were. Okay, so how can we turn this into a computational approach? So the starting point is going to be, again, to have the particular problem we're going to deal with is where we have a square where it's 0 volts on the 3 of the boundaries and it's 10 volts on this one. So that's one we could solve by separation of variables in rectangular coordinates if we wanted to. But what we're trying to do is to solve it a new way. And what we're going to have is a lattice of points And it's supposed to be a regular lattice of points in this spot. And the plan is to make a guess, a random guess, as what the voltage is at each one of those points. And unless you, you know, unless you're God, you're not going to guess correct, right? So the voltages aren't going to work. What we're going to then go around, and for every point, we're going to calculate the average of the neighboring points and use that for the central value. So we're going to go through this whole lattice, and we're going to, at every point, replace the average of the neighboring points by the, we're going to replace the value at the center with the average of the neighbors. You might think it would be a little bit, if a particular point is low, we're going to bring it up, and the guess is that that's going to then bring up its neighbors in the future. So you might guess that it might be smart to not just replace it by the average, but to go a little bit further, to replace it by a little bit more than the average of its neighbors. You don't have to do that if you don't want to. So, well, the point, so one could make all of this mathematically precise, but just kind of qualitatively, if a point is a little bit low considering its neighbors, so we bring it up, when we think about the neighboring point, it's now going to be higher because we raise that guy. So that means if we go back and rethink about that guy, it should be a little bit higher than it was. So we don't know how much to overcorrect, but it kind of makes sense to do a little bit of overcorrection. But we don't have to if we don't want to. So the plan is to go through this, and of course, it's not going to work. Things are going to be way off from our original guess. But we can do it again and again and again, and I mean, that's what a computer is great at. We can do it lots of times until it starts to work. And when we start seeing very small corrections, then we figure, it's good enough. Okay, so it's an iterative approach to finding the solution to one of these equations. The plan is to replace the value, to make a series of points inside the surface where we're trying to calculate the voltage, make a random guess, even a bad guess in the end will be refined to be good, but make the better the guess you make, the faster good is going to happen. And
that.
I can't think where we did that. So maybe that's for Jim.
No.
For me?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
I know what it is.
Yeah,
oh, is that what that was?
Yeah.
She's talking about the find root function.
Oh, the find root function. Yeah, so this is very, so computer solutions are very often iterative like that, where you need to, if you want to get to gold, you at least need some straw to start with. And good computer techniques will take gold and straw and eventually make gold out of them if you apply them frequently enough. So that's kind of the plan. So this is not a pleasant thing to do by hand, right? You would never want to, you know, take 10,000 points, 100 by 100 lattice, and calculate the average on your calculator and update it and then do that 10,000 times until you've refined your bad guess into a good guess. So how can we do this? So a real computer is the right solution for how to do this, but what I want you to do is to kind of see how this is all happening. And spreadsheets are good for kind of visualizing, you know, what's happening. No. Why did this get, you logged me out and then logged me in. That's okay. It'll take that long to get the thing warmed up. Okay, so if you go to the usual spot and you take a look at assignments.txt, what it says is, if we cursor on down to where we are. So here's kind of textbook ones that have to do with images. And here we're talking about numerical solutions. And what I say is we're going to solve Laplace's equation inside a two-dimensional box with 10 volts on the right-hand side and the other three at other places. And the plan is to use this code called relax dot numerics. And the claim is that that's going to do everything good for us. And there it is. So if we click on this guy, it's going to open in GNUmerics. So it claims it's already done that. There it goes. Okay, so here we have our box, which is 0 on 27 rows, and we have 27 zeros here, and we got 27 zeros here, and we have 27 tens there. What we need to do is to make an initial guess for all of these 27 square voltages. So, I don't know, that could be an unpleasant thing to do. But so let me comment first about what's the guess actually doesn't matter. You could choose any guess, and if you wait long enough, it'll work. But we know that the voltage, when we're close to one of these walls that is of zeros, it's going to be close to zero. And we know that if we're close to this wall of 10, it's going to be 10. So we might as well make a guess that has those kind of basic properties, that when we're close to one of these walls, we're going to get 0, and when we're close to that wall, we're going to get 10. And that guess, or a candidate guess, is right here. So what this is doing is it's looking at so this row tells me what row number I'm on, and 14 is the middle. So this is saying how far am I from the top and bottom, and this is saying how far am I from the column of 27, and I can paste that in. Do I have to actually hit copy and paste? Sometimes you have to do that. Okay, so this thing is going to be 0, but I want to propagate that every place. Okay, and we see that kind of makes some sense. Here in the center, it's close to 10 as we get to these edges. It's certainly not the right answer. So what we need to do is to refine things. Let me kind of make this a little bit smaller. Oh, smaller still. Okay, so if we look over on this edge, where is it? There it is. So what I have here is the formula where the central value is going to be replaced by the average of the neighbors. Right, there it is, the average of the neighbors, I'm putting that in. So let me copy that and paste that in the first spot. And let's propagate that. So we don't want to change the values on the walls. Oops. No, why is that doing that? Here we go. Okay, so I want you to do this repeatedly. Calculate the average lots of times. And spreadsheets have a reasonably nice way of doing that. F9. So if I hit F9, it's updating the spreadsheet. And what the instructions say is to do this until it looks like the pattern has stabilized. So I don't know, I've probably done this 100 times or so. It doesn't take very much time to get things. Still getting very occasional changes. Now I should comment that each one of these slots really has all of the significant digits, but I just want to display, you know, kind of one digit so we see roughly what's happening. But what exactly is happening? Well, what I say is that I want you to copy and paste what is pretty much a random value, the value at N14. So I'm going to copy that. And what I want you to do is to paste it, but paste it special as a value, not as a formula. Remember, there's a formula in there currently. So that's the current value of N14. Now I really do want you to count 50 additional ways. Okay, so that was 50 additional times, and if I try N14 again, so I want to paste it as special, not as the formula, but as the value. I get something that is changed a little bit. Right, so what you're supposed to do in the end is to continue this through, I don't know, maybe another 100 times. It only takes, you know, less than a minute to do this. And eventually you'll see that even these numbers aren't changing very much. So we've then reached a kind of stable pattern. So this kind of digit gives you a feeling for what the potential looks like. But we really like to have kind of a mathematical plot of what this potential looks like. And what the instructions say is to copy and paste these values onto a new sheet. And I want to paste these as values again, not with the formulas, but as numbers. And now I want to get these numbers into Mathematica so I can plot them up. And to do that, you want to do a data export. And we want Mathematica can read a comma-separated value file. So you want to save this as, I think I probably even tell you what I wanted you to save it as, but let's just use relax.comma-separated-value. What it's saying here is that comma separated value by definition only deals with one sheet. So there's no way you could save something that had multiple sheets in that format. We only wanted what it's got, so that'll be good. And then if you go back to the assignment, it tells you how you can then take that set of comma separated values and make a nice, well, shall I do that too? So there's one problem, incidentally, that you want to be a little bit cognizant of, and that is where was this thing stored? If you use the GUI version has to know where it is. This thing I can start where I know it is. So I can import that data, which I didn't call out, I called it relax. Did I not call it relax? Oh, is it in documents? I never save things in documents.
You know.
Data, export data. It's not, it's wherever that is. Okay, so let's put it in K-test. Someday we'll find out where that really was. Okay, so this time for sure, it works. And then we can do a contour plot. Then we can, there it is. Okay, you can see that things are a little bit boxy around the edge, and I don't know, huge electric fields are going to occur at this spot, right? Because we're going from 0 volts to 10 volts in zero size. But this kind of gives you an overall feeling for what the potential looks like, and kind of no surprise. Okay, so replacing functions by the average repeatedly is a good way to solve Laplace's equation. We're doing it in a spreadsheet, not because it's a good way to do it, but just so you can kind of see it all happening. So there's another program called CAP, which is going to kind of automatically calculate the solution to Laplace's equation for the case of a capacitor, a real capacitor. So it's a finite capacitor, and since there's symmetry, it's only going to deal with that piece of the capacitor. And you can adjust these parameters to look at various capacitors, and you can play with the relaxation parameters and all of that sort of good thing. Okay, and in the end, you're going to make a contour plot of its output also. Okay, so one of the things you're going to see here is this relaxation parameter. If you do better than just replacing it by the average, then you'll see that it converges faster. And so the other comment is, how do we know to stop, right? So in the case of the spreadsheet, I said, you know, do it 50 more times, time 4 or something like that. But how would you tell the computer when to stop? So typically what you do, how computers decide to stop, is when the change in the function is small, and you declare what small is. So this iteration parameter says it'll stop if no change was bigger than 0.001. And obviously, if you ask it to be changing less and less, it's going to take more and more steps in order to work its way through. Okay. So I hope you can see that with a little bit of work, I mean, you really could do the elephant, right? There's nothing that's particularly difficult about writing code where you just go through and replace the value in this lattice by the average value of the surrounding points. So first of all, the initial guess doesn't matter, right? You can choose anything you want. I mean, you could choose them all zeros or all fives. It'll eventually get the right answer. So what I chose was in here. And what it was is something that kind of looked at the distance to one of these walls. Did I already go past it? Oh, it's not very well defined, is it? Just sitting there in the midst of it. So this is what I used. So how far we were from the end, the column that you're in. So if we're close to the end, this number is going to be close to 1. And this other piece is saying, how far am I from the top and the bottom? What row am I on? And there are way better guesses than this, but this is not a terrible guess. And typically, for real cases, often it's not worth your time spending a whole lot of time to get a better guess, because you can see the time it takes the computer to do 10,000 of these guesses is 0. Okay, questions? Okay, so we are going to do iterative solutions, and there they are. Well, what I'd like to do is to spend time on another problem that I didn't assign this time around because it's kind of a mess. But I wanted to, well, I guess actually I did assign it, but at least I gave you some hints about it. And I guess the way I have in mind to solve this is what I would say is not the easy way. Method one, I would advocate method two, but you know, your mileage will vary. So the basic problem is that we've got one of these infinite planes that's grounded, and we have a dipole that is sitting outside of this plane. So you might remember that a dipole is charge separation. So we have a positive charge and a negative charge and a vector that connects them, and the magnitude of this dipole moment is the charge times the length. So this is plus Q and minus Q, some length there. So it's pretty obvious that the image is going to have far away the image of this plus charge is a minus charge, and the image of this minus charge is a plus charge. So we're going to have an image dipole like that. And it should be clear that there's going to be an attractive force between this dipole and the grounded plane. And what we're supposed to do is to calculate that force. So that kind of begs the question about, you know, what is the electric field due to a dipole, all of that sort of good stuff. So if we wanted to get the voltage, so right now, forget about the infinite plane. We're just going to talk about an isolated dipole. If I define the function phi to be kind of the usual 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught divided by 1 over r minus r prime, basically the thing without the q, because I'm going to separate that out. In order to make the voltage of this of a isolated dipole, what I want to do is to have a positive charge q that's located, and so let me make clear what my arguments are. So the arguments are going to be r and r prime. So I want the voltage at a location that is r prime plus L, and I want to subtract out, have a negative charge for the case of the negative particle at the original spot. Okay, and I hope it's clear that in the limit of L going to 0, what I'm going to have here is Q times L times the gradient with respect to the prime coordinates of this function phi. Is that clear? Dotted. Yes, no? It's just Taylor's series. Yeah, I'm subtracting them. Because I have the positive charge here and I have the negative charge there. Positive charge is at r prime plus L, and the negative charge is just at r prime. Okay, and here comes kind of the trick. Because r prime and r are exactly the same, except r prime has a minus sign in front of it, this is going to be minus the gradient with respect to r of phi. So I can switch the prime gradient for minus the gradient because they have exactly the same functional form, except when I take the derivative of the inside, there's going to be an extra minus sign from that. That minus sign isn't particularly clear. And what's good about this is minus grad phi is just the electric field. And Q times L is the dipole, and we know what the formula for the electric field is, right? It's R minus R prime vector divided by 4 pi epsilon naught magnitude of R minus R prime cubed, right? Okay, so let me make it clear what this is. This is the voltage due to a dipole. And I hope you can see that if this is the dipole located at, you know, some vector r prime, which I might as well have zero, and I ask for what the voltage is there, p dot that R minus R prime is going to be positive. So I'm going to, generally speaking, have positive voltages in front of the dipole and negative voltages down here. So the set of isopotentials look kind of like this. Right, so here would be voltage zero, and here would be positive voltages, and here would be negative voltages. So now to get the electric field due to a single dipole, I need to take minus the gradient of that thing. And that's kind of a mess. And it is I thought I wrote down the equation number that it is in the book. It's in the write-up. So it's in chapter 2, they do this, and the answer is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. I'm not going to have room for all of it, so there'll have to be a break. 3 times p dotted in r minus r prime, so that's a scalar, times r minus r prime vector, all divided by r minus r prime to the fifth, and then we have minus the p vector divided by the magnitude of r minus r prime cubed. So what we're trying to do, so we have here the formula for the voltage around a dipole. And what we're trying to do is to get the formula for the electric field of the dipole. And the reason is, what we need to do to figure out what the force on this guy is to figure out what electric field this guy is producing at that spot. Say again? That equation is in the book. Yep. And it's nothing more, quote unquote, than taking the gradient of that, but you can see that's going to be kind of a mess.
So it's R minus R prime is a vector?
So it's the dot product of P and R minus R prime. That's a number. And then that's times the vector r minus r prime, all on top of r minus r prime vector cubed, or fifth. You can see that basically this thing goes like 1 over the distance cubed, whereas the point charge had an electric field that went like 1 over the distance squared. Right? This may look like it's fifth, but there are two r's upstairs, so everything is really 1 over r cubed, basically. And maybe the other thing to talk about with dipoles has to do with the potential energy. So if we ask, what is the potential energy of a dipole in a previously existing electric field, what's going to be the answer? Well, the potential energy is, in general, the charge times the voltage. Yeah. So I did the logical thing and called the voltage V, right? But I'm not allowed to do that. The voltage is phi. So what we're going to have in this circumstance is we're going to have a positive charge that is located at R plus L, and we're going to have a negative charge that is located at R. And in the end, of course, L is going to go to zero when we make a point dipole. So that's what the potential energy is going to be. And you can see, I hope, that this is going to be QL dot grad of phi. And that's just Taylor series expansion. And of course, grad phi is minus the electric field. So this is minus P dot E. So the first thing to realize is low energy is where the dipole is pointing in the direction of the electric field, right? So this is low energy. High energy would be if the dipole were pointed away from the electric field. So dipoles will spontaneously twist until their dipole moment is aligned with the existing electric field. And we'll talk about that twist eventually. That's obviously a I'll tell you that the torque is P cross E, but we'll reach that eventually at some future date. So you remember that the force can be calculated as minus the gradient of the potential energy, right? So if I know the potential energy of the dipole in the electric field, I can take the gradient of it to get the force. And none of that looks to be very pleasant, right? Because the electric field formula is pretty ugly. And we have to dot it with the P, and then we have to take the derivative of it. But it does work. Incidentally, what I recommend in method two is to not deal with these dipoles, but instead to think about a plus charge and a minus charge that are separated by some distance epsilon. And then it's easy to figure out what this force is, right? This positive charge is going to be repelled by this guy. It's going to be attracted to that guy. If you just write down that force, there are going to be four terms in it. It's going to depend on epsilon, and then just take the limit as epsilon goes to zero. You okay with that? Yeah, because it's a point dipole, right? So here we made a physical dipole by actually separating the charges by an angstrom or so. But the mathematical dipole, we take the limit as the length goes to zero, the physical size goes to zero. Okay, so good to go with chapter 3.